There is no division between people who do the helping and the helped. I'm not just a helper. Like, the point of the works of mercy is we're all supposed to be doing it for each other.
Hello, and welcome back to Religion to Reality, where this week we're going to be talking about the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, from what they are in the first place to what they mean in living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Bliskey, joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Grbowicz. One of the more interesting takeaways from our discipleship study is that across the board, people said their greatest need for spiritual growth was with the expressive fruits. But before we dive into why we think that is, I think it's important for us to just talk about what they are in the first place. I guess I'll start. John, the way we defined it, we had a section of the survey that was dedicated to expressive fruits. And we didn't say that, actually. It was just a long list of like, how are you doing in these different areas of discipleship? But internally, we kind of used expressive fruits to categorize this section. And that section was giving, detachment and generosity, performing the spiritual works of mercy. And we kind of said, e.g., instruct the ignorant, counsel the doubtful, admonish sinners, kind of, et cetera, and performing the corporal works of mercy, e.g., feed the hungry, shelter the homeless, clothe the naked. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we're thinking about here. That's what we mean. Do you want to give any extra color to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just that, you know, an expressive fruit in general is just that your mindset and your way that you engage the world is just in some way noticeable. And that could be all the things that you just said there, but you show up for everything in a way that just seems to be influenced by something else that you really commit yourself to. Maybe that's too broad of a way of saying it, but I would look at it that way, that you just seem to show up in a way that's noticeable. It doesn't make you like necessarily look better or anything like that. It's just that you just really engage with things knowing that you've been really transformed by something interiorly in your life.
Right. And I think this is an important conversation in the life of this project, Religion to Reality in general, because this was sort of one of the breakthrough moments that we had when we were analyzing the data, noticing that it was the sacramental life that seemed to be no problem, at least in the eyes of, you know, our mass attending Catholics who were, you know, rating themselves essentially in these areas of the discipleship and their need for growth in it. They said, yeah, no problem. I'm attending mass regularly. I'm receiving the Eucharist. I'm going to confession. But when it comes to these areas of the faith, particularly, you know, the corporal and spiritual works of mercy, they ranked themselves as not so strong. And so we said, wow, well, I guess it's the case that, you know, people aren't living totally integrated lives if we are happy to go to mass on Sunday, but then, you know, not necessarily showing up for others, as you said, kind of in other areas of our lives.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it makes sense because, I mean, when you have something that's thought to be an obligation, first off, and thought to be the thing that determines your active participation in the religion that you have subscribed to, I mean, it makes sense that those things would be of paramount importance and noticeable, you know, showing up for Mass and things like that.
So for this week's episode, we spoke with three different guests who all have experience in living out the works of mercy in very different ways. First up, we spoke with Brené Rodin, a journalist and author who has been involved in the Catholic worker movement, currently living in a Catholic worker house, and also a previous employee of mine at DeSales Media. It was great to have her writing for us on the marketing team once upon a time, and also a fellow Notre Dame alum. So I know you had the chance, Father John, to sit down with Brené and talk about her unique experiences in living the faith as part of this movement.
We can shift to something here that's directly connected to the discipleship study. So we see that in the discipleship study that people's greatest need for growth was the expressive fruits. So there's lots of people who very much as a Catholic identify with participation in the sacraments, Sunday Mass, and being able to have some type of devotional life, prayer life. Where things kind of fall short is making concerted efforts, ongoing efforts to live acts of mercy, to bestow acts of mercy, to embody acts of mercy, that somehow gets a little bit pushed to the side. That for one to be fully Catholic means, yes, they are showing up for Mass, they are participating in the sacramental life of the church, they believe the church's teachings, and they do their best to live the moral teachings and things like that. But when it comes to works of mercy, it's like there's just not this high level of accountability that would somehow be distinctly Catholic, which is interesting, right? Because it almost seems as if other people who aren't going to church are the ones who are taking the lead in doing very merciful acts of compassion in the world. So like how, and Dorothy Day and Tahir Morin are perfect people who were able to show that these both feed each other, that they're not exclusive, they're not separate tracks, they really feed each other. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because the dichotomy between, say, the sacramental life and the works of mercy life, if we're going to call it that, those two tracks don't need to be two.
Yes. Well, immediately your question makes me think of just how many people will often come to Catholic worker houses and say, well, I don't feel like this is the one place that's sort of keeping me in the Catholic Church, or this is a place where I feel like I can be Catholic, and maybe they don't find that belonging in church. And I find that a very interesting comment. And I, in some ways, I think, oh, interesting. It occurred to me that they were saying something very true, that to be Catholic, we are supposed to be living out our faith, not just going to liturgy and worshiping together in church. Yeah, not just the liturgical aspect, but actually like we needed to also like, we need to live, we want to be Catholic. I think people are just dying to find ways to be Catholic and to have to really truly be marked by their faith. And the liturgical movement was such a huge influence on Dorothy and Peter that, you know, the late 19th century, early 20th century movement to really recenter the sacrifice of the Mass as the center of our devotional life as Catholics. We take that for granted now after Vatican II, right? That, you know, some of us aren't praying rosaries during Mass or during the Stations of the Cross, that we're all locked in, we're doing the Mass together. This is something we, the people of God, are part of and participating in fully. But that was really a reform of the liturgical movement, like taking us back to that root of our faith, right? Of those Sunday Eucharists that the first Christians would practice. So restoring that centrality of the Eucharist in Catholic life. And part of that, you know, Virgil Michael, one of the liturgical movement's leaders, was great friends, huge fans of Dorothy and Peter, of the work they were doing. He was so excited because one of the convictions of the liturgical movement was that the Eucharist contained a call for us to go be Eucharist in the world, right? To become what we received, as you say at the end of Mass, like go out to love and serve the Lord, right? Like Mass is actually a commissioning and a call. It's not just like, oh, great, come here again next week. It's like, no, there are 7 days a week. Like, go live this every other 6 days. And I think that's the role, you know, of the works of mercy and the social teaching of the church, is it shows us a program of like, this is how to live the Eucharist in our lives. And so I think, you know, it's interesting because I do feel like also coming at this from the other way, we can't have this division of just like, oh, well, I'm a soup kitchen person, this is my jam, and I'm a adoration person. Pope Francis says in The Joy of the Gospel that churches should not be serving the material needs or meeting the material needs of the poor and neglecting their spiritual needs. So really what he's calling us to do is to say, no, like our communities have to be integrated. We have to be, we can't just say, oh, well, like the poor go to the soup kitchen. It's like, no, you should be at the soup kitchen, sitting down, talking to someone, learning their name, learning their story. Maybe there's something you can do for them materially, but you should, you know, invite them to Bible study, see if they want to come to Mass, you know, like if they're Catholic, you know, you don't have to go like, proselytize in ways people don't want to hear, but, you know, people, but basically extend that community that you're a part of, that faith community, is not just for the people who are helping, it's also for the helped. And I think that's the goal of the Catholic worker, really, is to say there is no division between people who do the helping and the helped. I'm not just a helper. Like, the point of the works of mercy is we're all supposed to be doing it for each other.
I like that Renee reminded us that the point of Mass is for us to be the Eucharist in the world. That the Mass literally means to be sent, right? Go and proclaim. And that she equated that to being marked by their faith. That's what it, what's what the sign of being marked by one's faith is. Now, I've met someone who is, I think, a mainstay at one of the soup kitchens that I volunteered at. I think she works there. I don't even think it's a volunteer thing for her. I think she's like full-time there, but she doesn't go to church. I think that she knew we were like a visiting parish or something. And she kind of got prickly when I brought it up. And for her, like, her faith is being lived through that work that she does to meet the physical hunger needs of, you know, the community in her area. And that's beautiful, but she's also sort of missing the connection, right? And who knows? Like, I don't know what happened with her. There's a million reasons why people, you know, stay away from church, and many of them very valid, right? But I guess it's just nice to hear Renee, you know, someone I know personally, is really living out, you know, kind of both sides of that picture. Not that there's only two sides. I mean, we're sort of focused on two aspects of, I guess, the life of a disciple, when really there's, I mean, myriad ways that we kind of live our lives. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I used to always be very judgmental, I'll be honest, when I was working at soup kitchens or places that were, let's just say, engaged in acts of social justice, and being like judgmental, because I knew that they weren't really, let's just say, rah-rah Catholic showing up for Sunday Mass. I think I've kind of changed my feeling about that over the years. Based a little bit on what you were saying, I mean, people have reasons for not going to Mass. But I think there is something very Eucharistic happening in any type of encounter that people have when they really want to reverence and serve another. I mean, I think that that's really the sense of adoration that the Eucharist typically instills in people. You know, this whole sense of Eucharistic adoration, for example, or just being able to be fully present to the actions and the activity of the Eucharistic celebration. I think when people show up that way in the context of, say, of a soup kitchen, I think that's a very Eucharistic moment. So really the question is like, does the person want to be even strengthened in showing up for those moments in the soup kitchen? Is it possible that, say, Mass works the muscle to help them do that even more profoundly? I mean, I would hope yes. And in theory, it should be that way. But I do think there are some very profoundly Eucharistic moments happening in the context of the corporal works of mercy that are just as Eucharistic as actually attending Mass itself.
Mm. Obviously, living at a Catholic worker house or working on a Catholic worker farm is probably a larger commitment than most of our listeners are about to make as they contemplate and discern what the expressive fruits look like in their lives. But I do think that Renee's point about Pope Francis's words from the Joy of the Gospel about, you know, not stopping at the material needs of the poor, but also meeting their spiritual needs, is well said. And I think that part of the way I understand that is recognizing, let's say I'm at a soup kitchen, something that a lot of people have some familiarity with. Well, it's easy to, for me at least, it's easy for me to kind of be the like preparer of the food or even serving the food behind the line. But then actually going and having conversations with people after they start to eat or something like that, for me, is a lot harder, because now I have to actually encounter this person. I have to see how they're doing. And you know what? Like, that conversation doesn't need to go to be like, so where do you go to church? You know, like, that person might just need someone to talk to in the first place. You know, if you're not able to feed yourself, there might be some other things going on that are just as needed, such as having a conversation with someone who actually cares about how you're doing that day. And that is a spiritual need.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you're right. Those moments should be awkward in the sense because there is something unknown about what that person is experiencing or what they even say to you. And I think that that is very much at the heart of what mystery is. So it seems like if we talk about the sacramental life being a participation in the mystery of God, that same type of awareness happens in the awkwardness of approaching a person who you don't really know where that conversation is going to go. I think that's another way of piercing the mystery.
So For this episode, we also spoke with Father Jim O'Shea, a Passionist priest and co-founder of Reconnect, an organization founded to provide training, opportunity, and direction for at-risk youth in Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood. We spoke about what it means to lead a Christian life while being involved in community outreach. Somehow there's a disconnect in how they're living their lives. Clearly, you as a Passionist have made that connection deeply. And you keep using the term imagination, you know, changing the impact, the imagination of those being served, these children who, you know, need to maybe imagine a different way of living. But I'm wondering if it's the imagination of those who are trying to serve them, that's whose imagination needs to be changed too, right? Of like, what does it mean to live a Christian life? Now, what do you think is going on there? The disconnect between people, you know, receiving the Eucharist, but not recognizing the sacramental kind of nature of our world, let's say.
I mean, I think a lot of it in terms of like, I think there's a lot of fear. I don't know the words I would use, but I just think there has to be an openness to see this as a constitutive part of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. Like it can't be just so marginal in my life that it's like, you know, I give out a turkey on Thanksgiving and then somehow I check my box for, you know, this kind of radical call to be in solidarity with the world. I mean, Jesus is clearly in this radical solidarity that costs his life. I mean, I just don't think we're good at modeling it, number one. And, you know, people need to be accompanied into it as well. But also people, these are really transformative. Like my whole way of thinking has completely been transformed. Like it's not in my the way I think politically, the way I think, and I don't mean that Republican Democrat, but I mean politically what I think are values, how I see the world, the globe. You know, once you dwell in the world of disparities and like, I mean, I grew up obviously middle-class Catholic on Long Island. We were taught in great ways how to write all of this off. Like you would write Bedford-Stuyvesant off and you would never think of them. You know, you a lot of it is blame. I'm sorry to say we blame people. It's their fault, you know. So we create worlds that are very separate and we don't want them to be together. And I think the role of the church, certainly leaders in the church, right? Because I think somebody has to be willing. Like I'm a white, obviously a white man and almost 100% a person of color community, certainly in the first decade. That's a kind of a role. It's a very special role, like for my community in a sense. Like you need translators and you need people that can help people to kind of find their way into this experience. But it is threatening. And I think it messes with our narratives, and narratives are very important to us. Like how I see my narrative, my life narrative, my national narrative, my church narrative, my family narrative. And none of us want that narrative messed with. Mm-hmm. And these kind of experiences do that. They just start to upset it. And so sometimes we just pull away from it. That's all I'm saying. We don't, because if we do it well, our narrative is going to be upset. Just as the narratives of the people that lived in Bedford-Stuyvesant, their narrative is upset with my presence because I was upending some of their narrative. So, you know, they had written off the church, for example. So all of a sudden that narrative was changed. So, and even whiteness, you know, and all those kind of things. So I think that's part of the major, and I'm reflecting kind of on my own family history of, you know, you go to church, you do what you're supposed to do, but what you're supposed to do is not go to Bedford-Stuyvesant. What you're supposed to do is go to Catholic school, go to CCD, make your sacraments, go to Mass, you know, be a good person. But the demands of this other part of the God, of the real, this the demands of this, and the, I think the constituent demands, that's really never really, we never really were taught to enter.
Right. And I would guess that most people listening here had that exact upbringing that you're describing. I know I did. And I would say that most people listening are probably finding themselves in one of two camps. Either they are totally resonating with you. In fact, they maybe even listened to this episode because they're like, oh, expressive fruits, corporal works of mercy, spiritual works of mercy. Yeah, that's I'm all about that. Let's go. And they're like, you know, they're like you, and they see that integral to the gospel. And so maybe they are thinking to themselves, maybe I'm not activating others the way I could be. And then the other people who might be feeling a little bit indicted themselves and saying like, wow, maybe I am living a little bit of a whitewashed, you know, Catholicism or Christianity, and I'm not meeting people, you know, as Pope Francis likes to say, in the margins, you know, and so I guess my question to you is what advice would you give to each of these people, to either the people who are, you know, doing the works of mercy and maybe not activating, trying to invite others, not successfully inviting others to do so too, or to those who are not necessarily there yet, what change in their life can they make that, you know, might be uncomfortable at first, but is so important for them to do?
I mean, that's a very good question. I think one of the things that we all could do is start listening to people more than we do. Everyone doesn't have to go to, and Bedford-Stuyvesant, not Bedford-Stuyvesant as it is anymore, but you don't have to go to Bedford-Stuyvesant to do this. One of the biggest things I think we all can do is start listening to the people. There's so many people and groups of people that we have written off or decided their stories, decided what their motives are, decided why they are, what they are, how they are. You know, like, I mean, I've gotten into so many conversations with people, but I said, have you ever talked to anyone like that? Like now with migration, I'll use that as an example. It's another example that, and I'll, like, people will say things to me, and I'm like, we have some migrants living here and asylum seekers, and they'll go on this stuff. And I'll say, have you ever sat down and had any conversation with anybody that's actually an asylum seeker? Just listen to their story. You can disagree with them at the end and all that. No. Okay. I'll say, well, that might be something you might want to think about trying to do. And we should be facilitating those conversations, I think. But it's very hard once you listen to someone, to their story. And I'm talking about bad people. There's bad people in every group of people. So we all know that. Let's put them to the side. But the real central stories of human beings, like when I hear the stories in Bedford-Stuyvesant over and over again, I can't write that off anymore. I can't say what I learned as a kid growing up on Long Island is true. It's not true. That was a lie. And I have to undo that in my head and say, no, I'm hearing people's stories, watching their lives, living their lives, living with them, and sometimes actually experiencing the consequences that they experience. I mean, you get, because once you start standing with people, you sometimes get the same treatment by systems, powerful systems. And you start saying, wow, what I learned was wrong. And there's nothing wrong with saying that.
So there's that phrase again, John, listening. The advice Father Jim gives is, can we start to listen? And I think it does apply in both those groups, right? Whether we are currently working on activating ourselves or activating others, it's listening.
Yeah. And I think that the key thing is that it really requires to listen to people in your proximity who are, let's just say, easy to listen to. Like, you have to work the muscle of listening. We were talking about the other episode about, like, you know, the difference between listening and hearing. You know, it's a very lofty thing to say, we need to really listen to people who are very different than us. But let's be honest, it's hard to do that because, like, how are we even going to put ourselves in a position to listen to another person who we don't, you know, in a neighborhood that we don't visit or anything like that? I think it really starts with the people in your proximity, your own family, let's say, like, what are you doing to really listen to the people who you may have already kind of concluded that you understand what they're about and what they think and how they think? Are you pushing yourself to try to listen a little bit more deeply and maybe just asking, at least interiorly, the question, you know, why is it that this person thinks this, or why is it that they always feel the need to look at things this way or whatnot? And I think that that works the muscle to get you to the point of being more receptive to people who are in a different neighborhood or who you just kind of have a random encounter with, to listen to them more deeply and hear their experience. So I think you have to start with people that makes it easy for you to listen to, just the fact that because they're in your proximity.
Yeah, I think likening it to exercising a muscle is really apt here because there are so many similarities, right? Why do people work out? Why do people exercise? Well, they have some kind of goal that they want to either maintain or reach, you know, for their physical health and nutrition, whatever. And so they work out because they, you know, it's not because it's enjoyable every second of the workout, but because it's doing something for where they want to be overall, right?
Exactly.
And so Father Jim says, if we do it well, our narrative is going to be upset. Meaning if we are challenging ourselves to live with the marginalized or so forth. So I think, like, you know, what do I think this is like? So people go to the gym, not just because paying an exorbitant monthly fee, you know, is motivating, maybe that's part of it, but also because it's helpful to be around other people, right? Even if they're not actually doing the workout with you, there's something totally about doing things in community. It's why Exodus 90 is a group activity and not, you know, for individuals to do, because that's hard work and you're going to need some support along the way. And so, you know, in a similar way, you know, what I would say to people is, you know, if Jesus is your model, right? How can I, like, if a bodybuilder is your model for working out, then Jesus is your model for the spiritual life, right? And if that's the case, well, then think about who's the closest person to Jesus in your life. I almost can guarantee that one of the reasons you think that is because they're doing something like this already. Go with them. They would be happy to have you. They would love that. And just see what they do. Just accompany them. Get the strength and numbers going.
Totally. I cannot agree more.
All right, cool. So for this episode, we also wanted to talk about the ways in which we might practically be living out the works of mercy in our own lives, and maybe without committing ourselves to something like the contemplative life or intensive volunteer work. So to talk about this, we spoke with Christina Simmons, an author and the founder of Say Yes to Holiness, about the ways we may not be giving ourselves credit for some of the work we already do.
I think it's not so much a disconnect so much as it is a lack of awareness. We don't realize. So I taught confirmation for many years and was responsible for it at our parish. And one of the biggest things that I did is almost all confirmation programs, quote unquote, have, you know, service hour requirement. Mm-hmm. And so we still had that. The pastor at the time, he wanted that. But I changed it of where we focused upon the works of mercy and helping the young people recognize they were performing works of mercy in their daily life. So mm-hmm. one of the best stories that, and one of the, you know, most satisfying was a young man, and he kind of had been on the periphery. You know, he's one of those, you know, guys that, you know, he's there, but you're not quite sure he's all in, you know, that kind of thing. And he comes to me at the end of the year and he shares his service hour story, because I would have them do a short 200 words or less, you know, reflection paper on the impact that their service hours had on them. And he shared about how until we had talked about what the corporal works of mercy and spiritual works of mercy were, he didn't realize that he was feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, clothing the naked, and instructing the ignorant by simply sitting down with his younger brother after school, getting him a snack, and then helping him with his homework. And that, like, transformed his, you know, it's like, wow, okay, I'm actually doing these things. I'm being Christ to him in these moments. And he shared, you know, it wasn't just the service hour thing, but he's like, yeah, the relationship I have with my brother now is totally transformed.
That's really powerful for someone that age to recognize.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And so it's something where I think the disconnect happens because we think of all of these things as external to our daily life rather than. And so it's like, oh, if I'm going to feed the hungry, I got to go to a soup kitchen, you know. And, you know, I talk to the moms that I mentor all the time. It's just like, hey, you're feeding the hungry every single day you make a meal and put it before people. Yeah. And that doesn't give us a, you know, a buy, you know, it doesn't give us a pass on doing those things outside of our internal daily family life. But it's also something for us to recognize we are performing the works of mercy. Now, so that's the one, is lack of awareness. But then the second is not recognizing whose we are again. And that if we are, for example, receiving the sacraments, faithfully, and we're receiving them as we should, we're being given the graces that God wants us to then go out and share. And what, who we are, what we are, where we are, is exactly how God wants us to share his grace with other people. And when we begin to understand that we've been given this grace to be able to be fully who he's created us to be what we are, be it a mom, be it a, career, whatever we're about. And then where we are, I'm a Cursillista and I live my Cursillo weekend back in 2008. And there's a beautiful phrase about your movable square meter. And what that is wherever you are, the meter around you, you can put out your arms. That is your sphere of influence. So wherever you go, that is your movable square meter of opportunity to be Christ for others. And when we take that and then we go, oh, okay. So having a family that lost their house, because of a fire, and giving them housing for a couple of days until they're able to get on their feet and get up. I mean, that's, that's sheltering the homeless. I mean, but we don't think of those things as works of mercy. And so we think that we're not living it out when actually we are.
Good on Curcio for not translating the metric to standard for the Americans out there. We need to get more square meters in our lives, less square yards.
That's a good insight there, Dave. I do love the movable square meter image though.
Yeah.
That's so practical, right? I mean, everything, I think that's the thing when it comes to these expressive fruits that we're always talking about. Like, this is like, these are the practical ways that you show up in the world that are transformative for the people that you encounter, and probably more importantly for yourself. I think that when she's talking about wherever you are, the meter around you, you compel your arms, this is your sphere of influence. I mean, like, think about how much you are influenced by that, by the people in within that meter as well. I mean, it's always that give and take, and it just seems to me like we're always in a responsive mode, not like a defensive responsive mode, but like a way that's like bringing us out of ourselves and showing us what we're capable of doing, things that we haven't even thought about doing. I've just been thinking so much about how I think that we get in our head too much. And I think even going to mass and doing the ritual practices can be very heady. Like, we're going to these things because we know they're supposed to be encounters with God. And when we're there, we start hearing more words to learn about God. And then we're going to be taught about God, like through the priest or whoever. And it seems to me like these are really more heart encounters than moments of head meeting head, so to speak, where we're just kind of intellectualizing things. These are just movements of the heart. And that doesn't mean that the movements of the heart don't happen in the liturgy. Of course they do. But it's just, it seems to me that that's what happens when you're that close to people, in that, within that meter.
And I think that's a great way to understand why this isn't, this type of advice from Christina is not going to take people down even further down a path of just checking a box, right? Because it's like, oh, cool, I actually already do that stuff. Great, I'm good to go. No,
right.
That's a very head way to think about that stuff. Instead of what I hope it does is to say, as we examine our own lives already, we say, oh, not only am I already doing something that I didn't recognize I was doing, which maybe helps me love myself better, I don't know, like, which is always good for so many of us, but also that means that it wouldn't really be that hard to do it for someone else too, because I already am doing, I'm pretty capable of this thing. And I know what this is about in, let's say, my own family. For example, I have neighbors who have been bringing my wife and I meals. Our kid's almost 6 months. We just got a dinner delivered to our door 2 days ago from our next door neighbor, just because they had more and then why not? And they know that we're struggling with sleep and stuff. And like, that's amazing, right? Like, are we the hungry? Well, maybe not materially, like people showing up at a soup kitchen, but we do, struggle to find the time to be able to, cook dinner sometimes, and they're feeding their kids anyway. Like, why not just feed their neighbors too? It's a kind of a no-brainer sometimes when you think with the heart rather than the head.
And I think that also too, just this whole process of recognizing what you're already doing, it's not self-congratulatory. It's making it more intentional moving forward. It's just a way to realize that you're already been graced with the gift of responsiveness. And just by knowing it now and recognizing it and honoring it and being attentive to it, it just strengthens once again the muscle to be more attentive in the future.
That's right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Religion to Reality. We hope you learned as much from these conversations as we did, and that maybe you're walking away with some fresh perspectives on the works of mercy, from recognizing the mercy you are already giving to others, to maybe freshly considering how God is challenging you to care for those in need, or maybe those who aren't even in your life yet. Thank you once again to our guests today, Renee Roden, Father James O'Shea, and Christina Simmons. You can follow Renee's work at Renee, R-E-N-E-E, Darlene, D-A-R-L-I-N-E, Roden, R-O-D-E-N.com. Father Jim and Reconnect can be found at reconnectnyc.org. And you can find Christina Simmons at sayyestoholiness.com. You'll find links to all of those in our show notes. Please join us again next time, where we'll be getting a little meta with it and talking about podcasting itself. Once again, I'm your host, Dave Bliske, with my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich, and we hope to see you again next time. Religion to Reality is an initiative of DeSales Media created by me, Dave Bliske, and is produced and edited by Connor Donnelly. If you found value in our conversation, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you love the show, ratings and reviews go a long way toward letting others know about the show. Go to religiontoreality.org for more details and resources. And if you are ready to take the next step and join in community with us, check out the Called Learning Community, co-founded by Father John Gribowich. Go to calledcommunity.com to sign up for our free online gatherings.